Good evening, Russell. Welcome to the Space Show.
Oh, hello again, Andrew.
What telescopes do you have at the Anglo-Australian Observatory?
Well, we've got two telescopes that we're responsible for. The observatory is on Siding Spring Mountain in New South Wales, and the two which the Anglo-Australian Observatory operates are the Anglo-Australian Telescope, the AAT, which is a 3.9-metre classical optical telescope, and the 1.2-metre Schmidt telescope, which was formerly a purely British operation, but is now run jointly by the British and the Australians as part of the AAO.
Now, the Anglo-Australian Telescope, the AAT as it's called, is the biggest telescope in Australia, isn't it?
It is indeed, the biggest optical telescope by a big margin, in fact, and it's one of the two or three, in fact, it's actually technically the second largest in the Southern Hemisphere at the moment. There are three or four telescopes of about this sort of power and size in the Southern Hemisphere, and another six or eight or so in the Northern Hemisphere.
Every time I've been there, I notice there's a new thing to me, Bob, or whatever it is that's been added to it,
yes.
And it just seems to get bigger and bigger
yes.
and bigger. Now, this suggests that the telescope's actually got quite a bit of flexibility in it.
Right.
And, it suggests that maybe the thing was built to price, was built to specification rather than to price. Is that true?
Well, yes, that is true. It's true generally of optical telescopes that you can think of them as a big laboratory base, if you like, to which you can attach all sorts of different pieces of equipment. And the kind of uses that we make nowadays of the AAT are quite different from what was envisaged when the telescope was designed and built 25 years ago. And it was built to a specification. The people building it wanted to build the telescope as well as they knew how to 25 years ago. And one nice consequence of that is that it's a very, very high-quality mechanical structure, very good optics, very good electronic control system and so on. It's all very reliable and very solid, and it makes it an ideal base, which means that we've been able to put much heavier and more complicated pieces of equipment on it than anything that was originally planned. And so in that sense, it's been very nice compared with what sometimes happens in more recent telescope designs, where people are working to a fixed budget and they have to really cut corners a bit to stay inside budget, and they sometimes are forced to compromise a little bit on the actual mechanical or the engineering design of a telescope.
So the benefit of that has been that you have had the flexibility to change the operations of it
yes.
over time.
Yes, absolutely. The telescope was built in an era when nearly all astronomy was done using photography. Almost everything involved taking a photograph. And so the telescope building, if you go to it today, you find that there are probably at least a dozen little rooms embedded in the big building underneath the telescope, with photographic darkroom written on them, and plate store and plate processing laboratory and so on. And in fact, even in the very first days, by the time the telescope was operating, we were already moving mainly to electronic detectors, and so the kind of work that we're doing with it was already different from what was envisaged right from day one. And there have been such fantastic strides over the last 20 years in the power of the kinds of detectors we can use, especially the shift from the old photographic plates to what we called CCDs, charged coupled detectors, which are the kind of silicon chip detectors that are inside all the small video cameras and modern surveillance cameras and so on. We use slightly souped-up versions of those for astronomy, and they are just 20 times or 30 times more powerful than photography in terms of the efficiency with which they collect the light that we want.
So things have come a long way from the days when an astronomer got there and peered through the telescope at night, stargazing.
Well, indeed.
And maybe slapped a camera on the end to take a snap.
Yes, very much so. Because to be doing real astronomy, of course, for many years now, has meant doing something quantitative. For most of professional astronomy, you need to be able to measure something, because astronomy is a branch of physics. Hopefully physics will be a branch of astronomy eventually, but astrophysics is the name of the game anyway. And what we really want to do is to make quantitative measurements of things, and that's very difficult if you simply depend on the human eye, and it's actually still quite difficult if you use photography. But this isn't to say that we've never looked through the telescope. The AAT It does have eyepieces on it, and a few of us have been lucky enough to have a chance to look through it, but only in special occasions, essentially when we've been doing tests on the telescope or lining it up and making sure that everything's working properly, and we could snatch a few moments away from the official project to have a quick look at some beautiful globular cluster like Omega Centauri.
A surreptitious look.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, you've got to be careful because the brightest stars are so bright with a 4-meter telescope that you get, I don't think you damage your eyes, but you certainly get dazzled by the brightness of things up at the prime focus.
Yes, a bit like looking at the moon through a telescope.
Indeed, yes, yes. In fact, that's quite right. Even quite a small telescope, the moon becomes too bright.
Well, what do these instruments that you have on allow you to do that you can't do with, say, photography?
Well, the main thing is that we can, because the detectors are much more efficient and more powerful, it means that we can go and look at much fainter objects. That's the real crux. So we can look at much fainter stars, which sometimes means intrinsically faint stars, the smallest stars that exist. The search is for things like brown dwarfs, for example, which are the kinds of star right on the limit of burning hydrogen properly as a star, like the Sun. At the other range, more often, by going faint, it means you're going more distant. So if you want to probe the most distant parts of the universe, you want to look at the most distant galaxies, you've got to look at the faintest galaxies. And that means you need the most power that you can get to collect the light. And so each stage where we've gained in the power of the detectors, it's let us look further into space and to look at more distant things. And in the case of looking at distant galaxies at high redshifts, it also means that we're probing back in time and looking back earlier and earlier into the stages when the universe was much younger than it is today.
One of the things you've been working on, I believe, is something called 2DF. Now, this sounds like something out of a science fiction movie. What on earth is it?
Right. Well, that's a sort of acronym. 2DF stands for 2-degree field. To make it confusing for people listing things in indices at the backs of books, it's number 2, small d, and a large capital F, which is a funny sort of thing, but anyway, it makes it look modern, or it did 5 years ago when we started. The essential feature of this is that it's a device which lets us have a field of view, first off, as its name implies, of 2 degrees. And this is really quite an exceptionally wide field of view for a big telescope. Most of the big telescopes in the world, if you have no extra optics added to them, have fields of view of only a very small fraction of 1 degree. They really, most were designed essentially for studying one object at a time. You would point the telescope at the galaxy you wanted to look at, and that was it. The AAT was designed to have a wider field of view, up to 1 degree originally. What we discovered was that by adding some new optical elements, a very large new lens assembly, in fact, at the top of the telescope, we could get a field of view of 2 degrees. The importance of this is that it means that we can observe objects, a lot more objects at a time, a lot more quickly, and cover a lot more area of sky. And for projects like surveying the sky to understand the structure of our Milky Way galaxy, or, for example, for looking at the distribution of galaxies in the universe, you've got to do that. You have to have a very wide view. The second thing that you have to be able to do is to look at a lot of objects, and doing one at a time is no good. And so the other feature of the 2-degree field, or 2DF, is that it's fixed up. It consists of a set of optical fibers. It has about 400 optical fibers. And each fiber can be placed in the telescope in just the right place to collect the light from one individual star or galaxy. And you put the 400 fibers spread around in the telescope so that each one is collecting it, the light from these objects. And then the other ends of the fibers are brought together and fed into an instrument like a spectrograph, where the result is that in the spectrograph, instead of just seeing one spectrum of one galaxy at a time, suddenly we're going to see 400 spectra at once. And this means that the telescope is, if you like, 400 times more powerful if your job is trying to get spectra of lots of galaxies.
What do you mean by spectra?
That's a fairly long story. The light, as I think everyone knows, the ordinary light that we get, that we see by, which comes mainly from the sun or from an electric light bulb or whatever, looks white to us, or neutral, but in fact it consists of light of many different colours, and I guess Isaac Newton was the first person to demonstrate this, or to make it understood. When you shine the light through a prism, a triangular section piece of glass, it spreads the light out into the different colours. The same thing happens with the rainbow, because the light gets spread out in the individual raindrops, and you see the beautiful red, orange, yellow, green, and blue colours of the rainbow. Now, that spreading out is of the colours of the light is what we call the spectrum, because what the light is actually made of is what we call electromagnetic radiation, and this consists of light of all the different colours coming from atoms in the stars that we're looking at. And when we look at a particular star, if we spread the light out into its different colours, we can learn a lot about the star. So by studying the spectrum of each individual star, we can deduce all sorts of things about the star. We can measure lots of interesting, important quantities.
Some of these things are?
Well, the first one that strikes you when you do this is that you realise the stars are not all the same colour. Like, to the naked eye, they do look the same, but many of us now are familiar with these beautiful deep photographs that have been taken, for example, on the AT, but also many amateur astronomers have taken very successful, beautiful colour photographs of the southern sky. And you see that there are red stars and white stars and blue stars and so on. And the colour of the star is a measure of its temperature. Simply, a red star is, by star standards, pretty cool. They're just red hot. When they get a bit hotter, they get yellow hot, and when they get very hot, they get white hot. And so by measuring the colour, we measure the temperature. So that's one physical quantity, if you like, that the astrophysicist wants to know when he's trying to understand how is a star working and what's a star really doing. You want to measure its temperature. But you get a lot more than just the temperature. It turns out that each chemical element has a very characteristic signature in the spectrum, because atoms give out light of particular colours, and we know this, it's familiar to us from things like sodium street lights, which are a very characteristic orangey-yellow colour, or neon advertisement signs, which are very characteristic reddish neon colour, and that's because atoms of sodium give out this very characteristic yellow light. Now, if we take a spectrum of a star and we see the light of that particular colour in the star, it means that there are sodium atoms there, and this is exactly what happens. But what we can do is we can look at a star or the sun or any object like that, and we can see a very large number of lines of different atoms, so we can work out just what the stars are made of: carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, iron, and so on. And then there's a third thing which comes out from the spectrum, which is that we can measure the velocities of the stars by means of a thing called an effect called the Doppler shift, which means that the characteristic lines, colours of the light given off by the atoms changes, it becomes bluer if a star is moving towards you, and becomes redder if a star is moving away from you.
Well, Russell, what instrument changes do you expect to make to the AAT in the near future?
Well, for the last few years, 5 years or so now, we have been fully occupied building this 2DF instrument, because it was by far the biggest and most complicated instrument that we've ever attempted. During that time, there have been lots of other developments in astronomy, which mean we want to catch up with what's the most important research areas and in the technology and in what's feasible. And in particular, there have been a lot of developments with infrared array detectors. And these are devices that let you take pictures just like the CCD cameras work in the optical part with ordinary light. These are similar devices that work but with infrared light. Now, these have been in existence for a good few years now, but unfortunately, until the Cold War stopped and fell apart, they were regarded as secret military devices, and astronomers, by and large, couldn't get their hands on them. But suddenly, that picture's changed now, and very good detectors that detect infrared radiation are readily available. And we built our first infrared camera with one of these detectors about 5 years ago, and that was a very successful device. But it had a detector with just about 60 by 60 array of pixels, little elements in the detector. It was 128 square detector. Nowadays, the manufacturers are producing similar detectors, but with an array of 1,000 by 1,000 pixels. So that means that there are 100 times as many separate little detectors in this big array. And so we want to get hold of one of these big new infrared detectors and build ourselves a new infrared camera and spectrograph, which will let us do a lot of new astronomy.
And well, I just lead on to my next question. What new astronomy would it allow you to do?
Well, I think it opens up a whole area in the infrared. Two things happen. One is, in the optical, as I said before, we're always pushing to get fainter and more distant objects. But because the spectrum effect of the Doppler shift is the famous redshift, as you look further and further away and further back in time, the objects are getting redder and redder. So in fact, if you stick working in the optical part of the spectrum, you just lose everything. You get no light anymore because there's nothing coming from the objects, the most distant objects in the universe. So if you want to see those, you have to move into the infrared part of the spectrum. So that's one big reason to go that way, is just to capture the objects as at the very high redshifts. The second, a second big area is infrared radiation in space cuts through the dust the same as it does here on Earth. You can use infrared cameras to see in misty conditions. Out in space, it's the same. And in particular, if you're interested in the formation of young stars, where stars are being born, we now know that that goes on inside very dense clouds of molecules and gas and dust. But in optical light, we just can't see what's happening because we can't penetrate inside these clouds. By looking in the infrared, we can see right inside the clouds and we can see the young stars being born. So that's the second big area. A third major area where infrared work comes into its own is in the molecular clouds, again in a different way, in what you call interstellar chemistry. There are these exotic molecules forming in space, and a lot of them have their characteristic radiation in the infrared part of the spectrum.
Well, perhaps we could have you back on to tell us more about this exciting work that you're doing at the AAT at Coonabarra Brown. Thanks for joining us tonight on The Space Show, Russell.
Thank you again. I'd be pleased to do that at some future time.